From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, students allege that Berklee College of Music has a culture of tolerance around sexual harassment. Berklee President Roger Brown says he's making changes.
Look, this is the full catastrophe we're in the middle of right now. What do we do to take advantage of the fact that we have everyone's attention? Rather than adjudicate cases and investigate and terminate people, how do we stop the behavior from happening in the first place?
And the Remembrance Project takes a look at a Western Massachusetts man who lived a large life in a small town. Also today, as we approach the fifth anniversary of the Sandy Hook school shooting, how poets are responding to gun violence.
Here, the bells rock their heads of bronze as if to say, melt the bullets into bells, melt the bullets into bells.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Influential saxophonist and conductor Eric Hewitt has been let go from the Boston Conservatory at Berklee over allegations of abusive behavior and sexual assault. In a report released by the Boston Globe just this afternoon, several former students accused Hewitt of bullying and lewd phone calls. In one case, a woman told the Globe that Hewitt had taken her to his apartment, offered her drinks, and had sex with her as her consciousness faltered. Boston Conservatory Executive Director Kathy Young said in a statement that, quote, Hewitt will not be returning to the conservatory. Last year, Boston Conservatory merged with Berklee College of Music, and Berklee has been dealing with its own sexual harassment crisis, including allegations that the music school has a, quote, pervasive culture of tolerance for harassment, according to one student. Well, earlier today, I spoke with Berklee President Roger Brown. We met for an extensive interview before the news about Eric Hewitt's dismissal broke. Brown has been president at Berklee for 13 years. Last month, he revealed that over that time, almost a dozen faculty members have been fired for sexual misconduct. So I began by asking Roger Brown how many of those cases had he been personally aware of before last month.
All of them. I mean, I was involved in the process by which they were investigated and terminated.
Okay, interesting. So in that case, I mean, what's your response to some folks who might wonder, well, if you had 11 in 13 years, was there a point at which you thought maybe there's a deeper problem here?
Yeah. Well, first, let me set some context. Some people are unaware of the scope of this institution. We have 650 faculty at Berklee College of Music, about 250 at the conservatory. Yes, as I said, 11 is too many. And if I look back on it and say, what might I change? I think that we were very adamant about trying to get people to come forward and file complaints if they felt like they had been mistreated in some way. We were very proactive about addressing those and terminating people. But I think the realization I've had post the Me Too movement is just how ubiquitous this behavior is, just how baked into our culture it is for men with power to take advantage of that power. And how, unless we do something deeper than just adjudicate cases and try to actually change the culture, we're just going to continue to find people who cross the line and terminate them.
Right. So this question of power is really central because, you know, when you think about trying to put myself in the place of how a victim might feel, yeah. That first of all, they've had this interaction with someone who already has power, and then they're asked to go and speak to people, come forward to people who have even more power, right? When we're talking about university administration. You know, I was looking back at the coverage that the Boston Globe has been doing, and I'm just wondering what your response is to a couple of specific things about how folks in the past have said Berklee has handled some of these cases. Like, the Globe reported that the former student who reported being assaulted by one teacher, Jeff Galindo, she told the Globe that Berklee administrators initially discouraged her from pressing forward with a court case because Galindo would be dismissed. And I bring this up because of this question of power again. So, I mean, is that what happened? And if so, why would Berklee do that?
Yeah. It's hard to dispute the experience of a survivor and say that didn't happen or it did, because I wasn't there when those conversations happened. I can tell you one of the complicating things here is a student may talk to another faculty member or a staff member as a friend or to another student, and they may get advice that's not the official advice we give them as part of our equity investigation system. Not everyone is as fully educated about how this works. Every faculty member is a responsible party, and now according to our policy, they're required to bring a complaint forward. But I think one of the things the Globe reported is the survivor said she went to another faculty member who said, you know, don't report this. Just, you know, and that's not consistent with the way the policies are written or should work, but I have to acknowledge that it happens sometimes. So what we're trying to do is create multiple pathways for anyone who has been victimized to come forward, report it, be sure that it can be investigated properly. If they want to go to the police or the authorities outside the college, that's absolutely their right. We never want to discourage that. In fact, we'd sort of want to encourage it, because in a truly egregious case, we have limited sanctions. You know, we can't convict someone and send them to jail. So if someone does something truly egregious, it probably should go to the criminal justice system. So, you know, I'll be the first to admit that both our policies have improved dramatically. 3 years ago, we did a top-to-bottom review of our equity policies, put in a state-of-the-art system. We hired an outside consultant who helped us sort of study best practice at other institutions. So the system is constantly changing, improving, and evolving, but it's still an imperfect system.
So let me just ask you directly. Does Berkeley have a systemic problem with sexual misconduct amongst its faculty?
You know, it's hard for me to evaluate. Is 11, how does that compare to other institutions? Candidly, Magna, I think what we're seeing is this problem is ubiquitous everywhere. And we're seeing it lots of other colleges. And frankly, we're seeing cases where people brought complaints forward a decade ago and nothing was done and the person is still teaching there. At least at Berkeley, when a complaint was brought forward, we terminated the person at the time. Now, some students will say it took too long to do the investigation, but we have to do an investigation. There has to be some due process for the accused so that we can, you know, have a fair determination of what we believe happened. So, you know, all I can say is that we've had too much of this at Berkeley. Our students need to feel safe. They need to feel like they can trust faculty and staff and others to have their best interests at heart. And we're going to do everything possible to do the work to make it a better and safer place.
You know, I feel like this moment culturally that we find ourselves in now, it's a long time coming. And in a way, I'm glad that we're here.
Yeah.
But, you know, it requires empathy. It requires nuance, and it requires accountability.
Yep.
It just so happens that we have a lot of specific cases here at Berkeley. And so on this issue of, you know, there's the culture writ large, and then there's the culture on any individual campus. And I just want to read you one more thing. This is from a case that was filed with the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination earlier this year, at the beginning of this year. And a former student told MCAD that she had brought forth complaints against a coworker in one of the audio labs that she worked with. And Berkeley administrators had acted and said they'd monitor this person after they'd ordered the person to stay away from her, although that the former student alleges that the person did not stay away from her. But anyway, to the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, she said that she continued to observe and experience a pattern, practice, and pervasive culture of tolerance of sexual harassment at Berkeley. I mean, would you agree or disagree with that characterization?
If that's her experience, I can't disagree with it. Do we tolerate sexual harassment or assault? No. If someone reports it, we investigate it. We discipline people if the behavior is less severe than would require termination. And to me, the fact that we've terminated 11 people long before all this broke is a sign that we have taken this very seriously. And I think among our community, people know we take it seriously. So at this point, you know, I'm trying very hard for us as a community to not be defensive.
Yeah.
And to say, look, this is the full catastrophe we're in the middle of right now. What do we do to take advantage of the fact that we have everyone's attention? The world is understanding that this abuse of power is not limited to one institution or one sector of the economy. What do we do to change the behavior? So rather than adjudicate cases and investigate and terminate people, how do we stop the behavior from happening in the first place?
So very important set of questions off what you just said, because part of what I think or what I believe folks would say is necessary is more sunlight, right? I mean,
yeah.
Look, I'm a journalist. I'm always going to say we need more sunlight.
Right.
But I also try to look at patterns. And again, this is from, you know, the reporting that's come from the Boston Globe.
Yeah.
I'm seeing at least three cases in which some kind of settlement was reached by Berkeley and the various parties. But in each of those cases, a gag order was also included in the settlement. So if accountability and sunlight and creating a culture where people can talk about these things is important, why the gag orders?
See, I dispute those facts. I don't think that's accurate.
What part's not accurate?
In no case have we said to a survivor, you cannot talk about this case. So I assume that's what the reporter meant by gag orders. We've settled a couple of lawsuits where we had non-disclosure agreements around the settlements, which is very common practice, and I suspect the Boston Globe itself does that. But we didn't say to a survivor, you can't talk about this to the media. That's the very reason the media are doing these stories. And we have not called a survivor and said, we're going to sue you because you violated some gag order. So that's not a practice of ours. And, you know, another thing that the media alleged is that somehow we gave a positive reference to one of these faculty members so he could go teach at New England Conservatory, which is also false. We shared his employment records that said he was terminated for sexual misconduct.
When they asked
for a reference. And I have publicly committed that going forward, anytime our human resources department is called and asked for a reference, if someone has been terminated for sexual assault or sexual misconduct, we will report that. No institution I know of terminates someone and does a press release and says this person was terminated for sexual harassment. Maybe we as a culture and a society need to move in that direction. But to somehow say we were using settlements and gag orders to cover this up is just really unfair.
So to be clear, I want to be sure I understand you correctly.
Yeah.
Around specific legal settlements, there are non-disclosure agreements about the terms of the settlement.
Yes.
Okay.
So our intention has not been to prevent people who want to talk about this from coming forward.
It's interesting because the Globe, in one of these cases, spoke with or tried to speak with both the student and the student's lawyer, and they both seem to have come away with the understanding that there's a gag order around.
If that was one of the lawsuits, that may be true. I wouldn't call it a gag order. I'd call it a non-disclosure agreement. But, yes, I mean, in the cases of lawsuits, we did have non-disclosure agreements that we have to abide by as well. One of our main goals is to protect the privacy of the complainant or the survivor. Everyone in Title IX work will tell you that the thing that will chill people coming forward is if they feel like they're going to end up in a newspaper when they don't want to be. So we're trying to make sure that whatever we do is respectful of the survivor and his or her need for privacy. It's just not accurate to say that we have gag orders on survivors.
Okay. So you talked a little bit about 3 years ago, but right now, what do you think are the most urgent changes that Berkeley should be making to make every student, and let's be honest, every faculty member feel as confident and safe as possible?
I'd put them in two distinct categories. One is a system of reporting and investigation and sanctioning that is state-of-the-art, runs as well as it can possibly run, invites people to come forward if they have concerns, invites bystanders to come forward, even if the victim or survivor is unwilling to come forward. A roommate, a friend, a faculty member, a trusted person can come forward and say, I heard this. It makes it harder to investigate, but the more we can get people to share what has happened to them through a system where it can be investigated, the better off we'll be. But as I said earlier, the realization I've had is that is not enough. We need a top-to-bottom approach to culture change that educates people in our community about where the boundaries are as a respected faculty member or staff member, what abuse of power looks and feels like, not just egregious cases of it, but microaggressions where a student from another country might feel disrespected, a student who worships a different religion might feel disrespected, a person with different abilities or a transgender student, you know, all these microaggressions that exist, we need to clean up our act and make sure that we're respectful of every student who comes here because we can't expect her or him to be their creative best if they're feeling like they're not even supported by this institution.
How are you going to do that, though?
Well, we've put together a working group with 12 students, 6 faculty, 6 staff. We're going to meet twice a month for the next year. We have a plan that starts with, and we haven't made all these decisions yet, and I don't want all this to be top down, so I want the working group to come together. But we've had a bunch of great suggestions. I've met with hundreds of students, faculty, and staff since all this has been happening. So one idea is, should we collectively generate a statement of values and ethics that addresses some of this, and every one of us agree to sign that statement and live by it? Should we try to educate our students better about where those boundaries are, so that if they feel like a person is often predators, based on what I've learned, will start with a very subtle encroachment into someone's private space and see what happens. So how do we create firm boundaries so both the faculty and staff, as well as the students, know when a boundary crossing has happened? So I think more education, more dialogue, more discussion. We have a faculty development effort for a day and a half in January called Berkeley Teachers on Teaching, and we've basically tuned that whole training session to equity and these issues of harassment and assault.
You told the Boston Globe, I believe, that Berkeley is going to seek out a nationally renowned consultant. Mm-hmm. This is the Globe's language on federal sexual abuse and harassment laws. Can you tell us who that person is yet?
Yeah, we've identified someone. She used to do this work for the University of Southern California and then for the entire UC system. And she is going to help us both look at some individual investigations and make sure we did those properly. And then also help advise the working group about sanctioning policy. You know, what kind of sanctions should be applied to which kind of behavior. So she is identified, and she's already begun her work.
Can you tell us who she is?
Jody Shipper is her name.
Okay. Another thing about faculty vetting, because again, I'm thinking about lessons learned from cases that Berkeley has has had to grapple with. I mean, there was the case of Steve Kirby, who's now a former Berkeley professor, who had a history of sexual abuse in Canada that Berkeley didn't know about until
moments after we hired him.
Yeah, so that makes me but people in Canada had to reach out to Berkeley, if I understand, and let you know. So are you going to change how you vet?
Can I first start
faculty?
By saying there's another Steve Kirby employed at Berkeley who is not this person. He is a wonderful faculty member, and it's been hard on him through this period. But, yes, we hired a faculty member from the University of Manitoba. We checked 2 faculty references. We did a criminal background check. We asked him explicitly, have you ever been investigated for harassment or assault? He said no. We hired him literally days later. An article appeared in the Winnipeg Register saying he has been terminated for sexual harassment. And so we put him on leave within 24 hours of learning that. We called the University of Manitoba for information. They said, I'm sorry, we can't disclose that.
They wouldn't disclose
They would not disclose
So that. Even if you had asked them beforehand,
they might have said no comment.
Was he dismissed?
They might have said
left?
No comment, and we might have said, that's concerning. So what we did is we did our own homework, and we found some survivors who were willing to share the investigative report, and based on that information, we terminated him.
But what about in vetting future faculty who may come to Berkeley?
So, we will certainly always call the HR department. If I step back and look at the process, that was a step we should have taken that we didn't. And I think we're going to do more thorough background checks. The trouble is, as you probably know, most of these never become part of someone's criminal record. So a criminal background check often doesn't unearth a finding like this. So we're just going to be more diligent than ever, and particularly that step of doing an official inquiry with HR. And I do think it's worth, from a human resources point of view, a larger societal discussion about what do you disclose, what are you able to disclose. There's a huge amount of case law of institutions being sued by people who were terminated. The reasons were given to a future employer, and they ended up having to pay large settlements to the person who they shared that information about. I think that's an issue that is bigger than just Berkeley, bigger than just higher education.
So last 2 questions.
Okay.
I'm getting back to this issue, the fundamental core issue of power here.
Okay.
A while ago, we spoke with a lawyer and actually a law professor in New York State because he was asked by the New York State legislature to come up with a system of handling this exact issue up there because they had scandal after scandal. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he suggested and they did is they actually now have an independent investigator who doesn't work at the legislature. And in fact, it's this person. He's a law professor at City University of New York. So he's external to the system. But if someone has a complaint or a concern, they can go to him. Mm-hmm. So it creates an atmosphere of greater confidence mm-hmm. and trust mm-hmm. that a fair investigation will mm-hmm. take place. Is that something that Berkeley would be open to?
We're putting everything on the table, and that's part of what the working group is going to look at. We have used some people for external investigations, but we haven't had a system where people report directly to an external organization. If that's what it takes, we'll do it. I feel like we're making it really widely known how you report, and I think students are coming to trust the system better. But whatever it takes, that's what we're prepared to do.
Can this be fixed, do you think?
Fixed, no. Can it be radically changed and improved? Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we're already – I think we've made progress. I think we made a lot of progress before Harvey Weinstein. But I think this is a moment in time. This is a reckoning. And I want to be as strong and clear and ethical as I can possibly be in saying, if we get through this and do this right, we'll not only make this a better place, but we're sending our students off into the music industry, dance, theater industries, which have been notorious for exploiting young artists. So maybe our students can take the activism they've learned here out into those communities and say, let's make these worlds better. Let's stop this kind of exploitation.
Well, President Brown, thank you so very much for talking with me today.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Roger Brown is the president of Berklee College of Music. I spoke with him earlier today. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's take a minute now for the Remembrance Project, writer Alyssa Eli's look at the extraordinary lives of people in our community. Today, she remembers a man who lived a large life in a small western Massachusetts town.
Douglas Stutz. He and his wife were married for 58 years and raised three children, including daughter Christine Stutz Langdon, without moving away from small-town Massachusetts.
His family adored him, and I don't use that term lightly. I adored him. But it was beyond that. It was the community around.
After college, Doug took over his father's business in Greenfield, Stutz Electric. He ran it until industry in that part of the state began to languish. By then, with his support, his wife had gone back to college, begun her own career, and become the breadwinner. Doug closed his business and became the breadwinner's spouse. Theirs was a marriage of equals.
He was side by side, and in many cases, he was behind her, and he didn't have a problem with that.
He followed her to meetings around the world.
And my dad would be the trailing spouse, and he had zero difficulty.
Early retirement gave him more time for supporting everyone else. He would drive 2 hours to pick up a friend at the airport, or 6 hours to bring his grandson to a soccer match. He took it on himself to conduct a study of his church's heating system. He was an electrical engineer, and found ways to save thousands of dollars. In the 1970s, Doug was diagnosed with bipolar illness.
And what I am impressed with and proud of is how my parents together dealt with this. And hey, it wasn't easy.
Doug and his wife faced it openly.
They just made the most of that small town, and they've got an unbelievable network of friends. And during the years when my dad was suffering from bipolar disorder, having that community around them really made all the difference.
Decades later, when he needed dialysis, his greatest worry wasn't for himself. The medical staff had no portico over their clinic entrance, and in bad weather, that meant rain and snow.
And my dad repeatedly talked to me about what can we do to get the dialysis center to put a roof over the employee entrance. But that was the type of thing that was important to him because these are the people who were taking care of him, and he was very grateful to all of them.
Doug died within a mile of where he had grown up, having lived almost 80 years in small towns, creating his beautifully large life.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Douglas Stutz. He died last year in Greenfield. To suggest someone for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. Back in a bit. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow marks the fifth anniversary of the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. On December 14th, 2012, a shooter entered the school and killed 20 first graders and six adults. Brian Clements' wife is a former teacher at Sandy Hook. She was in her second grade classroom on the day of the shooting. Clements is a poet, and he's co-editor of a new anthology called Bullets into Bells, Poets and Citizens Respond to Gun Violence. And Brian Clements joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Sorry I fumbled my way through that introduction. This is one of those stories that still gets me every time I talk about it. But Brian, I actually wonder if you could start by reading one of, you included one of your poems in this anthology, and could you read a part of it to us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The poem is called 22, and the title comes from the fact that each of the sections of the poem talks about different instances of 22 caliber weapons, stories related to 22 caliber weapons throughout my life. Each of the first three sections has, I guess you might say, a kind of a flat affect, which I think reflects the way which we have come to expect and accept guns and gun violence around us in our day-to-day lives. And all that leads up to the fourth section. On December 14th, 2012, an armed gunman entered the Sandy Hook school with two pistols, a Bushmaster 223, hundreds of rounds of ammunition, and a shotgun in the car. Rather than turn right toward my wife's classroom, where she pulled two kids into her room from the hallway, he turned to the left, murdered 20 children and six adults, including the principal and a school psychologist, both of whom went into the hallway to stop the gunman and shot two other teachers who survived. After that, a lot of other things happened, but it doesn't really matter what.
That's Brian Clements reading a section of his poem 22 from the anthology Bullets into Bells. I just have to ask, because even though it's been 5 years, can you, that part of this poem gives us the smallest of hints of what that day was like, obviously for your wife, but for you, can you just remind us what it was like for you?
It was a nightmare for everyone in town, and it continues to be a nightmare. That kind of trauma is not something that ever goes away, and obviously for the 26 families who lost people on that day. Actually, they weren't lost. They were taken. It's a never-ending nightmare for those families. And there are kind of concentric circles of impact. They're the families who had a death in the family on that day. There are the other children who were in the building and saw things that children should never see and that adults should never see, and their families. Other people who were in the building who heard everything over the loudspeaker, their families, everyone in town in some way or another was affected and will forever be affected by that day for the rest of our lives. For some people, the impact lessens with time, others not.
Yeah.
Around the turn of the season when the trees start losing leaves, you begin to hear people talking about the foreboding sense that the anniversary is coming and people start getting out of town.
Yeah. So tell us, what's the idea behind this anthology? Because it's many poets and a variety of poems, not all of them about Sandy Hook. It's about gun violence as a whole. So how did this anthology come about?
Well, shortly after the Sandy Hook shootings, I knew that I wanted to do something to contribute to this fight against gun violence in our country. And the only thing that I knew how to do was to put my training as a poet, as a writer, as an editor, as a literary organizer to work. And I talked to a couple of other organizations about doing a project like this that never panned out. But then shortly thereafter, a couple of years later, I was contacted by my friend, the poet Dean Rader, who had been in conversation with Alexandra Teague, another poet, about doing a similar project. So we decided to join forces on this book. But I made it clear to my co-editors that I was not really interested in doing this book as a literary project. I don't see this as a literary project. I see it as a conversation among Americans.
Yeah.
And for that very reason, I thought it was very important to include the responses from gun violence survivors, families of victims, activists, and political leaders like Senator Murphy and Nobel Peace Prize winner Jody Williams. So each poem has a response from one of those folks.
Who wrote the response to your poem?
The response to my poem was written by Po Kim Murray, who is the executive director of Newtown Action Alliance, okay, which popped up after Sandy Hook.
And what did Po Kim Murray say, just briefly?
Well, I'll give you a brief taste of it. You'll remember that the last line of my poem was a lot of things after that happened, but it doesn't really matter what. Poe said, it did not matter to the NRA, the Republican members of Congress, Donald Trump, Republican governors, Republican state legislators, and some Democratic leaders that my neighbor killed his mother in her bed, then drove to Sandy Hook Elementary to brutally gun down 20 children. She goes on to say, it mattered to us. Mm-hmm. It mattered to 90% of Americans who support expanded background checks. It mattered to families of victims and survivors directly impacted by gun violence. Because it still matters to us, we will work to hold all state and federal elected representatives accountable for standing with the NRA instead of taking action to keep all of us safe from gun violence.
Yeah. You know, one of the things about poetry that I don't know why I was surprised, but it surprised me as I was looking through the anthology of poetry about this subject, is that the poems marry this, you know, beautifully crafted, artful language with this raw emotional honesty, which generated in me everything from like this wild spectrum of feelings, mm-hmm, from hope to rage all over again.
Exactly.
Is that something that you were that you, is that part of the conversation that you're hoping to
create? Absolutely,
and
the conversation is very, very differentiated. You know, there are people who are rabid anti-gun people. There are some pro-gun people. It doesn't really matter whether you're pro-Second Amendment or anti-Second Amendment. It doesn't really matter whether you're pro-open carry, anti-open carry. We have gun violence problems that we all have to work together. But poetry, as you say, has its very power and its emotional impact.
Yeah.
What can poems do that essays and op-eds can't do?
Well, I want to give people another taste of what's in the book. The anthology is called Bullets into Bells. And in fact, the title of the collection is based off a poem in the book. And that poem is called Healed the Cracks in the Bell of the World. And author Martine Espada actually read a little bit of it for us. And here it is.
Now the bells speak with their tongues of bronze. Now the bells open their mouths of bronze to say, listen to the bells a world away. Listen to the bell in the ruins of a city where children gathered copper shells like beach glass, and the copper boiled in the foundry, and the bell born in the foundry says, I was born of bullets, but now I sing of a world where bullets melt into bells.
So that's Martina Spada reading a little section of his poem. We've got his full reading at our website, by the way, radioboston.org. Do you think that's possible? Do you think the vision that he's created in this poem is possible, where we can pound bullets into bells?
And swords into plowshares?
Yeah.
Very eventually. I don't think that it's something that's going to happen in the near future. But there are a lot of small steps that we can take. There's a bill in Congress right now to improve the background check system. That's a small step we can take. Unfortunately, Congress also has a bill before them on concealed carry reciprocity that would essentially negate the effects of the background check system. Our hope with this book is that people will be emotionally moved enough to get more involved than they have been, or to get involved if they haven't been, and to contact their representatives and make clear to them how important it is that we stop gun violence in this country.
Yeah. Well, the book is Bullets into Bells, Poets and Citizens Respond to Gun Violence. Brian will be at the Boston Public Library tonight with his fellow co-editors of the anthology to talk about the collection. We'll have information about that at radioboston.org. Brian Clements, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, I know that along with listening to Radio Boston every day, perhaps you listen to Modern Love, the podcast. It's from the hardworking, talented people at WBUR and our colleagues at the New York Times. You might have heard of them. I'm lucky enough to get to host that show as well. So for the rest of this week, we're going to share excerpts with you from recent episodes of Modern Love, starting with the story of Artis Henderson. Now, in life, you can choose your significant other, but you can't choose your in-laws. So when Free Spirit Henderson first met her future mother-in-law, a conservative churchgoer, they did not hit it off. But she never could have imagined the event that would bring them together. In this episode of Modern Love, actor Constance Wu reads Artis Henderson's essay. It's called Marry a Man Who Loves His Mother.
When Miles and I decided to live together, I asked him if his mother, Terry, would be upset. We sat at the kitchen table in his apartment near Fort Rucker, Alabama, while the warm fall evening pressed against the sliding glass doors. Miles would graduate from flight school in a few months, and the Army would be sending him to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. My job in Tallahassee would be ending at the same time, and the move felt right to both of us. "Don't worry about it," he said. He leaned back in his wooden chair and propped a foot against the leg of the table. "She'll probably want to send us a housewarming gift. Go ahead and think of something." I thought placemats would be nice. Terry came for a visit 3 weeks after we moved into our tiny rented house on the outskirts of Fort Bragg. She did not bring placemats. She was tense and unsettled, the way I remembered her, and she refused to stay in our guest bedroom. She stayed in a hotel across town instead. In our home, Terry was cordial. She cooked dinner, churning out Miles's favorites, like burnt steak stew, meals with a history that reached back to their hometown in Texas. She made the sugar cookies that Miles liked, the kind I could never get right. And she talked about home and church and family. On the second day, after Miles had put on his uniform and left for the base, Terry suggested that we drive to the mall in Raleigh. Spring unfolds slowly in North Carolina, and the air was cool and damp, even as the first daffodils pushed through the wet earth. We climbed into her rental car and drove through Fayetteville, where rhododendrons bloomed pink against the gray morning. The rain started when we reached the interstate, and Terry launched into the reason for her visit. "You know, Brad and I don't approve of you living together," she said, referring to Miles's father. She called it living in sin. Her hands gripped the steering wheel, and outside it poured and poured. "When he has sex with you, he's disrespecting you." I thought about telling her that he sometimes disrespected me on the couch. Once in the kitchen. She talked for an hour and a half without pause, without my input. But when we reached the shopping center, the space between us seemed somehow easier. We spent the afternoon shopping, as good friends often will, inspecting sales racks and eating Chinese in the food court. At the makeup counter at Macy's, Terry tried on lavender eyeshadow. "That looks nice on you," I said. She smiled shyly into the hand mirror. When the saleswoman asked if she'd like her to wrap it up, Terry nodded. She was strangely tentative about the exchange, as if she weren't used to buying nice things for herself. Later, after the visit, I asked if Brad had liked the new eyeshadow. He didn't notice, she said coolly. The distance had returned. In the summer, we stopped at Miles' home in the Texas Panhandle on our way to Fort Hood in the central part of the state. His unit would spend 9 months training there before heading to Iraq. As we turned off the highway onto their gravel road, a steady wind blew. It stirred the dry grass and ruffled the cows in the pasture. Miles spent his days outside under the big Texas sky. He rode horses and worked the ranch with Brad, while I stayed inside with Terry. She showed me how to make her meatloaf and wrote the recipe for her sugar cookies on an index card for me to take to Fort Hood. She talked endlessly, hardly pausing for breath. It was as if she weren't used to having an audience and needed to unload the things she carried in her heart. She talked about Miles, about how long it took to conceive him, about the miscarriages that came after. She numbered her lost babies among her children. She talked about breastfeeding, sleepless nights, and Miles' sweet baby smile. She cornered me once about the move to Texas, but before she could get into the sinful parts, someone interrupted the conversation. Anyway, Miles and I were married in less than a year, and by then the point was moot. At Christmas, we were back in the Panhandle. The Henderson clan had assembled for the holidays, and they were a hard-drinking, hard-partying lot. They gathered at Uncle Rick's Canyon House, where the cousins played cards and drank Coors Light, while Aunt Minnie chain-smoked on the back porch. Terry greeted them each with a stiff hug. She fit oddly into this mix. She was raised a Catholic, and her mother still went to Mass every Sunday. But when she married Brad, a conservative Protestant, she set aside her faith and adopted his. While Brad's family were church-going folk, none of them approached religion with his hard-line zeal. So while the drinking and cussing and sinning carried on around her, Terry kept herself apart. At one point in the card game, someone asked Miles where his mother had gone. He hooked a thumb over his shoulder toward the back room where the kids watched cartoons. The cousins rolled their eyes and snickered. Miles was the only one not to laugh. On the day Miles was deployed, after we left him at the hangar on the base, Terry came back to our apartment. She helped me pack up our life so I could go home to my family in Florida. Together, we boxed the towels and the bed linens, the crock pot, and the TV. We loaded them into Miles's pickup, and Terry drove the truck back to Texas, where it would wait for him to come home. When he did come home, it was not the way we expected, but with an escort and an honor guard and casualty assistance officers. Terry told me that when the notifying soldier came to her door, she wouldn't let him speak. "Stop," she said, and held up a hand. "Just tell me if my son is alive." "No, ma'am," the soldier said. "He's not." I couldn't imagine that kind of backbone. I had listened silently through my own notification, then thanked the soldiers as they left. But later, when it had all sunk in, this new reality and the things we do when we lose someone we love, her reaction felt right. Miles was the best of her. He had her face, her build, her Texas twang. As much as he was to me, he was more to her, more viscerally hers. They shared DNA, for God's sake. After the first few months, after the unspeakable sadness of the funeral and learning the horrible details of Miles's death, Terry came to Florida to help me sort through the things sent back from Iraq. There were two black plastic bins filled with Miles's possessions, carefully labeled and organized, still covered with a fine dusting of Iraqi sand. Although they were legally mine, I was next of kin, after all, it didn't feel right that I should have sole access to them. We sat in my garage with the doors open while heavy sheets of rain poured down outside and sifted through Miles's life in the desert. We sorted through his notebooks and office supplies, his rolled socks and army fatigues. We flipped through his CD collection and we paged through his books. When it was all too much to remember, too much life packed into those plastic containers, Terry stopped and she pulled a T-shirt from the pile. She raised it to her face and breathed deeply, searching for some trace of Miles. She did not know what I knew, for I had already done the same. The army had laundered his clothes before sending them home, and this, too, was lost. What remained was the space created by Miles's absence, thick and palpable with our grief. Losing a spouse is in no way like losing a child, but all loss is in some way like losing ourselves. In the months after Miles' death, Terry and I struggled to reorient our own lives. And in that search, we found each other. We began to bridge the distance that had been between us, bringing our shared love for Miles into the unknowable middle ground. At the military briefing following his death, we saw photos of the citrus orchard where his helicopter crashed, and we read the final seconds of audio from the in-flight voice recorder. "Pull up," Miles had said at the very end. Terry stood behind me during the hardest parts, pressing her small hands into my shoulders. I have heard people say that you should never marry a man who does not love his mother. I was lucky. Miles loved his mother fiercely. He loved me too. In losing him, Terry and I have not divvied up his love as we have his other things. We have discovered that there is more than enough to share.
Constance Wu, reading Artis Henderson's essay, "Marry a Man Who Loves His Mother." Wu stars in the ABC sitcom Fresh Off the Boat, now in its fourth season. And I hope you enjoyed this sample of Modern Love, the podcast. If you did, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and make sure that you've got Radio Boston's podcast in your queue as well. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Cassandra Sunt and Lily Tyson. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.